Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Sounds and Sights of Cinema here on WHIE Radio and DVDVerdict.com. I'm your host, Clark Douglas, and we have another good program for you today. We return to movie reviews this week. Later on in the program, we'll have a review of the new comic book blockbuster X-Men First Class, starring James McAvoy, Michael Fassbender, Kevin Bacon, and January Jones. But right now, on the musical side of things, rather than spotlighting a particular composer or genre or film or anything of that sort, we're spotlighting an instrument, the piano. Yes, we're spotlighting film music, which either highlights the piano prominently or only features the piano by itself. And some very interesting scores for you on today's program. We're going to begin with what I think is one of the great piano scores from composer David Shire, written for Francis Ford Coppola's The Conversation. Take a listen. Thank you. music written for The Conversation by the great David Shire, one of cinema's more underrated composers, to be sure. Next up, a score that features the piano and quite a lot of other instruments, but a really wonderful score from composer Jerry Goldsmith, written for a film starring Michelle Pfeiffer entitled Love Field. Let's take a listen.
Thank you.
music from Love Field, written by Jerry Goldsmith. We continue now, spotlighting the piano on the Sounds and Sights of Cinema, with another score that features a number of other instruments in addition to the piano, but a score that actually earned an Academy Award nomination from composer Alan Silvestri. It's his music for Robert Zemeckis' Forrest Gump. Take a listen. And that's some music from composer Alan Silvestri, written for Forrest Gump. Next up, we turn to Mr. James Horner and a score that the piano is prominently featured in, Searching for Bobby Fischer. Enjoy! Thank you. Good stuff from composer James Horner, written for Searching for Bobby Fischer. Next up, we move along to Mr. John Williams once again, and his music for Steven Spielberg's Munich. Now, not all of the music that you'll hear features the piano, but some very prominent portions do, and it's used very well indeed. So take a listen and enjoy.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Sounds and Sights of Cinema here on WHIE Radio and DVDverdict.com. I'm your host, Clark Douglas, and we're spotlighting film music featuring the piano on the program today. Next up, Mr. Dave Grusin provides us with his memorable score for The Firm. Enjoy.
Thank you.
Man, is that a terrific score or what? That's from composer Dave Grusin, written for The Firm. Next up, a score that we absolutely had to feature on the program today. I don't think you can do a program about film music featuring the piano without spotlighting a selection from The Piano, Michael Nyman's score for Jane Campion's wonderful film. Let's take a listen to some of that effort.
Thank you.
music by Michael Nyman, written for the piano. Of course, we had to feature that score today. Next up, Oscar-winning composer Jan A.P. Kaczmarek. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I'm sure I'm butchering it horribly, but this is his Oscar-winning score, actually, for the movie Finding Neverland, starring Johnny Depp. Let's take a listen to this lovely selection.
Thank you.
music written for the film Finding Neverland. I do hope you've enjoyed the musical part of the program thus far. And it's now time to move along to this week's movie review of the new film X-Men First Class. I've always had a bit more affection for the X-Men franchise than it honestly deserves. Prior to the release of X-Men First Class, four installments of the series had been churned out, only one of which had actually been a really satisfying picture. That would be X2, X-Men United. Despite this, the immense potential lurking within the depths of the franchise is undeniable. Part of the reason that a film like X-Men The Last Stand is so frustrating is that it's obvious the film could have been a terrific summer blockbuster had it been handled better. Rather than actually rebooting the series, Fox decided to launch an in-continuity prequel, which would explore the origins of the mutant superhero team. So how does X-Men First Class fare? Well, the series still has a lot of potential. Our story begins in the 1940s, when young Erich Lynscher, played by Bill Milner, is a prisoner in a German concentration camp. During his stay there, he's tortured and experimented on by a Nazi scientist, played by Kevin Bacon, eager to learn more about Erich's unique magnetic abilities. Fast forward to the early 1960s, as an adult Erich, played by Michael Fassbender, is on an unrelenting mission to hunt down the man who tormented him all those years ago. It's during this process that Erich meets Charles Xavier, played by James McAvoy, a professor of genetics with his own set of fascinating abilities, of the telepathic variety, of course. To make a long setup short, Charles and Erich decide to join forces with a handful of other young mutants and aid the CIA in a mission to prevent nuclear war from breaking out. Over the course of this mission, the two men's sharp philosophical differences begin to become apparent. How much longer will the vengeful Erich and the peaceful Charles be able to continue working together before their personal ideologies split them apart? Obviously, the answer is not much longer. We all know where these characters are going. It's up to X-Men First Class to make the journey there compelling. I suppose you could call it a success in that regard, as the film is rarely dull or uninteresting. Even so, this semi-reboot of the series gets an absurdly large amount of things wrong. It's appropriate that the film opens with a scene mirroring the opening scene from the first X-Men, as this film mirrors the close-but-no-cigar quality level of that movie in a variety of ways. There are a variety of problems with this flick, but the most immediately noticeable one is the screenplay by director Matthew Vaughn, Jane Goldman, Zach Stentz, and Ashley Miller. Too many chefs and all that, I suppose. There's an embarrassingly large amount of flat-out awful dialogue in the film, much of which comes from scenes in which characters casually make up iconic names. No, you're not G-Men, you're more like X-Men. On numerous occasions, I was able to silently quote lines from the film before the characters even delivered them. Sadly, this was due to by-the-numbers writing rather than recently developed telepathic abilities. In addition, character development is an enormous problem. Several of the characters go through very abrupt changes without any proper setup. The blatant social commentary, an element used skillfully in the Singer films, is handled very awkwardly this time around. It's as if the writers were completely disinterested in that element of the franchise, and half-heartedly stuck in a few lame slogans just for the sake of it. "Mutant and proud" becomes an increasingly ungainly catchphrase. Additionally, the film's attempt at period design is laughable. It's very easy to forget that you're watching a film set in the 60s. You're suddenly reminded of the film's era when a character casually slips the word groovy into a sentence, or JFK turns up on the television, or Kevin Bacon turns up in a silly ascot. But there are entirely too many anachronisms killing the retro vibe. This problem is perfectly symbolized by the end credits, which fuse a hip Saul Bass-style credit sequence with Henry Jackman's thoroughly modern action score, save for a handful of occasional 007-ish twangs. The film relies far too much on simplistic fan service, those cornball moments designed to generate applause in crowded theaters that will fall completely flat when viewed at home, though a fleeting cameo from a franchise veteran is a pitch-perfect delight. The film also suffers from being burdened with the task of doing a boatload of setup, as it seems to spend nearly its entire running time setting the stage for other, more interesting films. The Cuban Missile Crisis-themed central plot of this outing proves a good deal less interesting to watch than it must have seemed on paper. there's at least one gaping plot hole that many audience members will notice, too. And yet, I remain interested in this incarnation of the franchise and those other better films that it may produce. Why? As I said, there's still a lot of potential. For all of the movie's faults, you have to give it credit for spot-on casting. In particular, Michael Fassbender and James McAvoy are superb as the future Magneto and Professor X, respectively. Fassbender sells some very weak material simply with the steely conviction of his performance, while McAvoy is even more disarmingly charming than usual as the bright, amiable Charles. In addition, Nicholas Holt gives a young Hank McCoy an effective Clark Kentish quality, while Jennifer Lawrence turns in solid work as a conflicted young Mystique. Kevin Bacon has a ball hamming it up as the villain, January Jones' stiff screen presence actually works well for Emma Frost, and Rose Byrne is an appealing presence as CIA agent Moira MacTaggert. The cast for a terrific X-Men is undoubtedly in place, and they're what keep X-Men First Class so thoroughly watchable throughout. Fassbender, in particular, commands attention every time he strolls on screen. He's as strong a presence in this film as Ian McKellen was in the others. This is easily director Matthew Vaughn's weakest film to date, and considering he co-wrote the screenplay, he can be blamed for many of its problems. But he does bring a level of stylistic flair and energy to the proceedings that set it apart from the others. Bryan Singer had much better control of tone, but his considerably more dour approach would have amplified this film's weaknesses. For instance, an obligatory training montage is turned into frisky fun due to Vaughn's impressively fluid use of split-screen techniques. Still, X-Men First Class is a mediocre film rescued on occasion by surface-level pleasures. It's kind of fun while you watch it, but it sours in retrospect and will likely fare poorly on repeat viewings. The stage is set for a splendid X-Men adventure if the filmmakers can muster one. One can only hope that the magic will actually happen next time. I'm going to be nice, though, and give it 2.5 stars out of 4. And that concludes our time together on the program today. I do hope you enjoyed the show and that you'll join us again for more music and movie reviews next time. Right now, we close out with Mr. Billy Joel. Have a great week, everyone. Back at you later.
They say it takes a lot to keep a love alive. In every heart that pumps a different beat. But if we shift the rhythm into overdrive, well, we could generate a lot of heat. A 52nd Street. Oh, oh, on 52nd Street. We're gonna have a little soul parade. Before they know the second bar was played, we're gonna slip it to them short and sweet on 52nd Street.